speaker is Crashing the Boys Club, Women in Skilled Trades. We have three speakers. We have Amy Bronson in the middle, who is a PhD student in political science at Wayne State University. She's retired from the Skilled Trades Shop Bargaining Committee, Local 7 UAW. Welcome. We have Amy Peterson, who is president of Non-Traditional Employment for Women. And we have Laurel Parker, who is a student at Empire State College and an IBEW Local 3 up front. We're going to have each speaker speak for about 15 to 20 minutes. I'll just kind of wave my hand when you're close to the end, and then you can just wrap up at that point. We're going to have that issue, but and we'll finish at 12:15 probably.
It's sort of sequential. And I was very fortunate to have both academic and shop floor experience. I was also very fortunate in having a family of my parents, my partner, my kids were very supportive about being active in the union and all the time that that takes. And I'm also a second generation tradeswoman because my mother was a machinist during the war. And this was something that I really valued and really made a difference to me in deciding what I was going eventually to do. When we put together this panel, we thought it was very important that what we talk about is lived experience, not just the academic side of what happens to women. And so while there's a great deal of academic literature concerning the creation or recreation of gender identities, such as the groundbreaking work of Cynthia Cohen, Alice Kessler Harris, and Leslie Salzinger, their concepts of human agency and power lay the groundwork to describe women's resistance to domination, contestation over meaning and identity formation. And also autofactories have been looked at in the academic literature. In the past, Steve Myers' work on masculinities and autoplants form the backdrop for what women see when we get there. And Nancy Gavin, Ruth Meyerowitz, and Pam Sugerman talk about gender discrimination in autoplants in a historical perspective. But really, actually, very little work has been done academically recently in analyzing the persistence and change on the shop floor for women in skilled trades, and if there have been any changes in shop floor norms. Skilled trades and auto plants remain gendered terrain as men continue to hold more than 98% of the positions. Break areas and workspace are gendered terrain. They are considered male spaces. And really, when we started working there, defended by men. And so at the end of this, and this is a situation around 1990, and in the 1990s, some tradeswomen contested this exclusion and endured discriminatory job assignments, but we still continue to refuse to see this break areas just to the male tradeswomen. So much has changed since the 1940s and 1950s, but more recent incidents remind us that the playing field is still not gender neutral. I'm going to talk about a woman that I knew in the Jefferson Avenue assembly plant of Chrysler Corporation. It was a historic case, a tragic ending, and no one's ever talked about this before that I've seen. And I'm talking about a woman named Linda Gilbert. And Linda began her apprenticeship as a construction millwright in Local 1102 in Detroit in 1986. And for the 4 years of her apprenticeship, she was the only woman in her training program. She was the only woman on the job, wherever she was. She became a journeyman in 1990 and then was hired at Chrysler's Jefferson plant in 1992. At the Chrysler plant, she was the only woman in any trade out of about 400 skilled trades employees. In 1993, what was a short time chronologically, but a long time in terms of changes. Our plant put on about a half dozen women apprentices in the electrical and pipe fitting trade. I was one of the first ones hired in November of 93. And all women there are subject to some form of harassment at some time in their apprenticeship because we work with so many men. But Linda's case was different, and not just because she wasn't an apprentice. This is not just a story about what one trial woman described as the worst treatment he had seen in 31 years at Chrysler. She was relentlessly pounded with derogatory statements, with no help at all when she was given a job. And she was subjected to physical danger because she was forced to work alone rather than with a partner. This is not a case of body jokes or men posting pictures of women. It was a deliberate pattern of behavior to send a message to Linda that women did not belong in the skilled trades of Chrysler and that she ought to quit. This is more a story about the refusal of management to protect Linda Gilbert's rights under the law and the refusal of the UAW to enforce her rights under the contract. Within the first few months, a number of senior millwrights began a pattern of harassment really designed to drive her out of the plant. From urine in her chair and her clothes, to dildos in her toolboxes, to many more things, she was subject to a level of harassment far beyond sexist pictures or lewd comments. Behavior was so obviously offensive and so clearly visible that some men in other trades, not millwrights, removed some of the harassing pictures, cartoons, jokes from hanging on her toolbox, because they knew how offensive it was. They recognized that, and they knew how much it would hurt her feelings. The harassment continued, however, unabated, despite her repeated attempts to tell management, to tell human resources that this was going on. And when management and human resources failed to do anything about it, Linda filed a sexual harassment lawsuit in circuit court under the Michigan Civil Rights Act of 1994, but the case was not heard until 1999. At trial, one human resource employee admitted that the investigation into Linda's claims was inadequate. Another testified he wouldn't even know how to investigate an incident of sexual harassment if Linda would not give him the name of the offender, although there was a whole group of them. Another HR rep promised he would give her a phone number of someone at the union who could help her, and then didn't do that. Her supervisor testified that his intervention consisted of passing out Chrysler's sexual harassment policy, but that he also failed to follow the usual procedure when a policy is passed out, of making everybody sign that they received a copy of it. He asked the men as a group, together, if they knew who was harassing Linda, and then later testified that he understood that his failure to speak to each man separately and alone made the investigation inadequate, but that wasn't his job. After this procedure, human resources made a decision not to take any further action. They would wait until somebody came by and told them that they had seen something. And in the court transcripts, they stated they were working within the frame of the union and the local agreement, and that's it. Chrysler's trial strategy was to question and minimize the level of harassment and to blame Linda for not being more active in helping stop the harassment. She only made 6 official reports to HR. She had a troubled past and a history of drinking, as if that were anything unusual in the skilled trades. They said she should have reported all incidents to HR instead of to her supervisors, even though Chrysler's written policy said you reported it to the supervisor unless the supervisor was the problem, which sometimes they were. They never did an investigation. They never, for example, used hidden cameras, which is what Chrysler does in an area where valuable parts are being stolen. They'll post a camera somewhere to catch somebody at it. And they didn't do that. They testified that the language, that the behaviors, not just the language, but that the behaviors were horseplay or shop talk. That management didn't know anything that there was a pattern. They asked Linda if she had been a tomboy and why she had put herself in a position of being in a profession that was historically dominated by men. All of this was put forward even though the same circuit court had previously ruled, quote, "We do not believe that a woman who chooses to work in the male-dominated trades relinquishes her right to be free from sexual harassment." Chrysler also rejected a mediated settlement that would have paid Linda $100,000. That's about a year's pay with overtime, which Linda had agreed to accept. After a five-week trial, the jury ruled that Linda had been subject to severe and pervasive sexual harassment in the workplace that, when considered as a whole, constituted a hostile work environment. The court further found that she had made Chrysler management aware of these incidents of harassment, and that in any case, the harassment was so open, so visible, that Chrysler management was given what lawyers would call constructive notice. That is, anybody who walked by could see it. They didn't need any special notice, even though they got that. The jury further found that Chrysler's remedial action, suggesting that they move the victim to another area, and distributing copies of the anti-discrimination policy on sexual harassment was insufficient to immunize the corporation from liability. The jury's 1999 finding of sexual harassment over a seven-year payment resulted in an award of $21 million, which is the largest single award ever awarded by a jury. Linda never saw it. First, she was very uncomfortable with the size of the award. It was a plan, and we'll talk about her plans. She was thought work. We'll talk about her plans to give the money to foundations that prevented sexual harassment or abuse of children. She would say constantly, "I just wanted to make sure that this never happened to another woman ever again." Despicably, Chrysler appealed the decision. The Michigan Court of Appeals subsequently upheld both the verdict and the award as not excessive. However, in July 2004, the very conservative Michigan Supreme Court overturned not just the amount of the verdict, but the verdict itself, and by a 4-3 decision, remanded the case for a brand new trial in circuit court. This is not a complaint where the lawsuit started exactly 10 years. Linda was unable to deal with the idea of going back to trial. Most of the witnesses who testified on her behalf were scattered or were retired. And she relapsed into alcoholism. I spent a lot of time with her. I had been her steward for about a year and a half. But in September 2004, I was out of the plant recovering from knee surgery, and Linda was out on medical. And I got to know her far better during that period than I had when I was just her union rep. She had chronic obstructive pulmonary disorder and a heart condition, and she died in November 2004. But in examining the role of the company and the union, I am not ignoring the attitudes and behavior of individual groups or men. Rather, the institutional structures created by the company and the union reflect those attitudes, embody gender differences, and created the gender spaces which men then protected against what they saw as the intrusion of women. In the final analysis, it became clear that in developing corporate practices to prevent sexual harassment, Chrysler was far more interested in instituting a bureaucratic procedure than it was in changing culture on the shop floor. It was more interested in demonstrating and had put into place those policies that would limit their liability in the future rather than creating a sexual harassment-free workplace. The formal policies opposing sexual harassment existed side by side with these informal structures that were not gender neutral. Even as Chrysler Corporation, if you wouldn't mind giving me a hand just walking these around, even as Chrysler Corporation, some kind of order here, was in the oral argument phase of the appeal in 2004,
it announced that it was sponsoring something called 2004 Lingerie Ball. This is an extended advertisement that was to be aired during the 2004 Super Bowl. And it consisted of two teams of supermodels playing tackle football wearing sports bras and briefs. While their Chrysler's own sexual harassment policy would have prevented the posting of their own advertisements on the floor, this did not stop them from spending their advertising money organizing this spectacle. When an outcry forced Chrysler dropped the sponsorship of the lingerie ball, they shifted advertising dollars to Maxim magazine's Circus Maximus, held in Houston, with Dodge's new Magnum wagon pulling a circus cage full of hot chicks dressed as lions and tigers. It appears that even a $21 million award was not enough to make them get it. By the late 1990s, however, addition of a third production shift created substantial changes. Eventually, there were almost 20 women in the trades, which at that time had about 675 trades at that time. As apprentices, we were not isolated. We were together in training programs, in school, and we met other women apprentices from other plants in the training programs. In addition, they brought in a handful of women who were journeywomen in the outside construction trades, and they came in as journeyman trades. In addition, we were dealing with an influx of a younger male workforce, and that when we graduated as apprentices, we were senior to them. And this, being higher in seniority in a plant as opposed to in a construction trade, really shifts the power relationships in the factory. However, not everything had changed. Each of us, at some time, was told we didn't belong there, wasn't women's work, and their son should have the job. There was discrimination in assignment of overtime, which the union refused to do anything with. And I never heard of a single woman journeyman being given an apprentice to train. But there were as many different responses to harassment as there were male-female interactions. Different women had different levels of sensitivity to magazines or photos or jokes. Some women chose to sit alone and not interact with anybody. And just watch their equipment. This was easier to do if you were an electrician, for example, because you ran a whole area and you weren't sitting in a crib like the millwright was standing. Some other women chose to hang out just with women, whether they were tradeswomen or production women. Others were aggressive and verbal and pushed back as rude and nasty as any of the men were dishing it out. I was the only one who chose activity in the union as my response to politics, gender politics, and I was elected the first woman skilled trades chief steward and the first female shop committeeman and bargaining committeeman elected by and from the skilled trades, the big three. If there have been any other reps, women reps for skilled trades, I haven't found. So why does Linda's story remain so important, even as women today move somewhat more easily through these gendered spaces? Well, first, it was because Linda did everything she was supposed to do. She was very good at her job. Nobody denied that. She reported harassment. As a good union sister, she refused to accuse somebody because she had no evidence, just suspicion of who was participating in it. And she sought help for her drinking problem. She just wanted people to be left alone to work, do her work and to have a partner for safety reasons. She was willing at trial to accept $100,000 because it was never about the money. And she was completely vindicated by the jury, who found the harassment so egregious and management so irresponsible that it awarded her far more than that $100,000. And then, however, as is so often the case, when things are decided by courts, instead of by social movements and political social movements, the higher court took it all back. Linda should have had the best medical care. Instead, she didn't even know she had a heart condition until the plant doctor had the nurse take an EKG and sent her out. She died as she had lived, alone in a two-bedroom flat in a cul-de-sac, for their own dog, and only two tradesmen went to her funeral, myself and one other woman. Linda had no strategies for fitting in, for learning to belong, or for letting things run off her back. Even if she had, it wouldn't have been enough, given the vicious and sadistic level of the attacks. But more to the point, she shouldn't have to have had a special way of placating men, either by being funny or cute or helpful. By the time I got to know her well, she had been so beaten down by the level of harassment and the exhaustion of this 7 years of harassment and the trial and the appeals, that even if she had wanted to have some strategy, I don't think she could have carried it off. The real issue is she should have just been permitted to be Linda, whatever Linda was, however she chose to put herself forward. That's the atmosphere we want to create. Secondly, Linda's situation is really not a thing of the plants. In plants, while space is still gendered, and 2% women is not a lot for skilled trades, that is a big three, the much younger cohort of men don't feel that they own the plant in the way that the senior men believed when we started there. And in any case, they have too much to lose, and there are too few jobs out there to indulge their attitudes, even if they have them. And production is now approximately 25% women, so isolation for women in the trades is never really complete. But in small shops, and also in the building trades, the women's situation is still much closer to Linda's than to mine. A woman can work for years as the only woman on the job or work site, or the only woman in a smaller factory in the trades. And there's no protection for these women by seniority as we had in unionized shops. But it's going to be up to this next cohort of women in the skilled trades to develop the strategies that work in their workplaces. The third thing that we've learned is that we have to build a movement in our workplaces as well as on the outside, which promotes gender equality and equal access to jobs. And we cannot rely on inadequate laws, pro-company courts, corporate management, or even sometimes our unions as they exist today. However, women cannot do this alone. Without building bridges to men who understand and oppose harassment on the job, we remain isolated. It would not have taken much if there had been a group of men in the skilled trades who approach these millwrights and tell them to stop. And men in other trades saw what was happening and tried to deflect some of the harassment and the postings on this toolbox. Nobody walked up to these men, certainly not the union stewards, and just told them this was out of line. So unless we have these bridges with the men in our shops, we remain vulnerable. We're less able to function as union members and to force our unions to become actively involved in fighting sexual harassment. I have to say in conclusion, though, that in all fairness, in my years at Chrysler, I saw not just a change in the cohort of men who worked there, but even a change in individual men. And one of the highest accolades I ever received, besides being elected in an almost all-male shop, was when one of the men told me that, having known me, he would never think of his daughter's options for careers in the way he had before. In the plants, at least, each succeeding male cohort is also more likely to have wives who work and daughters who aspire to go to college. And women in the trades have to be able to position ourselves and develop our own working class vision of feminism if we're going to be able to succeed.
Thank you all for coming today and having us here to talk about this. So I'm Amy Peterson, and I am the president of an organization called Non-Traditional Employment for Women in New York City. I don't know if any of you have heard of this. I don't know if the two of you heard of it?
No, text me.
Oh, okay. Have you heard of it?
No.
Okay, so we've been around since 1978. So in 1978, the federal government set a requirement for women on construction projects as tradeswomen. So not as managers or clerks or anything like that, but as tradeswomen. 6.9%. Back then, there were about 1 to 2% women in the trade. And that was in 1978, and it was the same year we were created. And if you think back to 1978, where women were in a lot of different industries, doctors, lawyers, engineers, architects, construction workers, we were a very low portion of all of those industries. So now it's 32 years later, and women have come very far as doctors and lawyers, and architects a little less far as engineers. But in the construction trades, women still are only about
3%. And you're talking ICM construction
dimension? Yes, but I mean, we're New York City, so I don't think they're more represented in the non-union. You know, we work with the unions, so we work mostly with the commercial and the large high-rise residential, but we don't find that they're a higher representation in the non-union, which does have smaller work. And so that's, I think it's dramatic and it's awful. The reason that we focused on these jobs as an organization is because of what that chart demonstrates. If you look at a traditional woman's career, home health aide, child care worker, things like that, the salaries are very low and there's very little career path for you. If you look at the construction industry, an industry that you can enter with only a high school diploma or GED, you start already at a higher wage than most minimum wage jobs. Women were placed in jobs average of $15 an hour starting wage. But then through the apprenticeship program, which I'm sure Laura will talk more about, you end up at a level of $50 an hour. And you can really go from low income to middle class through the construction unions, through the skilled trades. And we strongly believe in that. We strongly believe in the unions because they do provide equal pay and equal wages and benefits and opportunities for advancement. They put a huge investment into the apprentices that enter their program to help them gain the skills and get to the level that they're at. But here we are in 2010, and we're still, we don't have the most recent statistics, but we're still very close to 3% in terms of the number of women in these trades. And we've seen a lot that's happened over the last 32 years in terms of the acceptance of women into the trades, the number of women who want to go into the trades, and that diversity of the work that they do in the trades. The women who went through our program in the 80s and the 90s suffered very much the same fate that Linda did. They were pioneers. The women today are still pioneers, but they were pioneers like you've never seen. And they were put into situations where, you know, the construction industry was a different place 5 years ago, 10 years ago. So a lot of the things that have happened that are making the job site a better place to be, a lot of the focus on safety didn't exist. The old boys' network was very pervasive. We honor a woman every year at our luncheon, and last year we honored Liz Lopez, and she's a plumber. And she talked about how, you know, she went onto this job site and she couldn't believe how quiet it was. You know, the job site, and then she realized it was quiet because every single person on a huge construction project had stopped and turned to look at her because she was a woman, and they weren't used to that. And so those women stuck it out, and everyone today owes them a debt of gratitude because they really, you know, the argument certainly for the first 20 years of our existence, and even today people make the argument, is women can't do this work. So those women have proven that women can do this work, and a number of them, sadly, we had to add it up the other day, and we think it adds up to about 20, have risen to positions of leadership in their union. So they are shop stewards, probably more than
in child stores. They're instructors in the apprenticeship program. We have a couple who are organizers in their union. Very few kind of in labor management or in leadership positions in their unions, but some as delegates. And so it's very hard to make the argument that women can't do this work when you have women who have proven that they can do this work. So what we do as an organization is recruit women, which historically has been very difficult, and we just finished a 5-year strategic planning process, and we just finished our last 5-year strategic plan. And 5 years ago, certainly, there was a perception that you could not find women to come into the trades, and that we couldn't get enough women to come in the door. And that's because every woman, every girl, has never, ever been told that they can be a carpenter, or a plumber, or an electrician, and they can do this work. So even the women who go through our program today tell us, and we've talked to a lot of them, the funders and other groups, tell us that everyone has always discouraged. They've always thought, I'm handy, you know, I'm good at this stuff. And everyone has always discouraged them, from their mothers, to their partners, to their teachers, to anyone. People have always discouraged them. What we did recently through support from the MTA and other people is put an ad campaign out with pictures of our women on the subways in New York City, and we're getting calls and calls and calls, and they've been pictures of the women who've gone through our program, and they look like women, and they look like the people that are looking at the ads, and we find that our best referrals, people get excited about the subway ads, but our best referrals are the people who see a woman in a hard hat riding the train home and ask her, you know, how did you get into this position, how did you do this? Interestingly enough, we're also having men construction workers go up to a woman on the job site and ask, how did you do this? My girlfriend should do this. She can't find a job, things like that. So it's interesting to see now we're getting people to come in that path. So we recruit women because otherwise, you know, it's very hard to figure out unless you're a union person whose father was in the union or uncle or brother. You know, how on earth do you become a union member in New York City and the building trades? Aside from go and stand on the line for a long time and get an application. So we recruit women into our program, and then we have a very tough 6-week, what's called a pre-apprenticeship training program. And so the women have to have a high school diploma or GED. We test them for 7th grade reading and math. Half of the women don't have 7th grade math, despite the fact that they have a high school diploma or GED, which is a huge reflection on how women are told about what they can accomplish in that. That's a topic, but one that I feel very strongly about. We help women who don't have the 7th grade math get that so they can enter our program. We have women who come to our program, and one of the things that I think makes our program unique in the kind of workforce development world is we have women who come to our program who have been in the homeless system and have really troubled background, and we have women who've gone to college and have degrees, and they're in a class together, and it really helps, I think, each of them learn from the other and to move forward in our program. So our program focuses on that. It focuses on health and safety. It focuses on strength, lifting and carrying. You have to carry a 65-pound mud bucket on your shoulder by the end of class, which is not an easy thing to do. And then we have union carpenters, electricians, and painters teach in our shop hands-on skills. You have to show up every day early for class. If you don't, you're kicked out of the program, because in construction, if you don't show up early every day, you're not going to ever work. And it's a tough program, and historically we've had a 75% graduation rate, but our graduation rate's gotten a little lower. We're not sure if it's the economy or we're getting tougher, but it's tough to get through the program. And you have to want this. I mean, there's a lot of programs out there where you can kind of get a job, but this is a career. You're about to embark on a 4 or 5 year apprenticeship program. This is something that you really have to want to do. So they go through our program, they graduate, and we place them directly into the unions. We have, because of the history of the fact that there are no women in the trades, or very few women in the trades, the State Department of Labor has recognized that and allows women from our program to go directly into the unions without having to go through the regular public process, which has been very helpful. The unions our board has really worked in the last 5 to 8 years on becoming partners with the employers and the contracting communities. We have a lot of people on our board that care about this issue. A lot of women now run construction companies, so we have the women in New York City who lead the biggest construction companies on our board. And so the unions have, through some negotiations on making sure there's more union work out there for everybody, have said that they'll take 10% women in each apprenticeship class, and they take them from our program, and they like to get the women from our program. They can get some random person off the street, male or female, or they can get somebody who went through that recruitment screening 6-week pre-apprenticeship training program. So they like the women that they get that come through our program, and they have been taking about 10% women, and it looks like there's about 7% women now in the apprenticeship programs in New York City. Carpenters and laborers both are about 15%, and that's amazing, and that's an incredible statistic, and it's really done a lot, I think, as you were saying, for kind of the new generation of tradespeople who are coming in, certainly the apprentices that are coming in, they're used to seeing women and working with women, but the apprenticeship program is just the first 4 years of what's probably a 30-year career. So if there's 7% in the first 4 years, there's still only 2 and 3% in the next 26 years. So I don't think we've gone much up from 3%. We might have, you know, hit 3.5 to 4% now. And one of the reasons, so we've been going through the strategic planning process, and we've done this great job of getting women into the apprenticeship program. And when you're a first-year apprentice, you work a lot, you're cheap labor. When you're a first-year apprentice, everybody's treated badly. So the women don't necessarily face more sexual harassment, more harassment than other people. Everybody has to do kind of the rough work and stuff. Everybody has to get coffee has to make a contraction. But it's hard to advance. And as women try to advance through the apprenticeship program and get to journey level, we have found through our strategic planning and through market research that they face all of the things that you might imagine they would face, and they really have a hard time getting to journey level. And it all goes to the things that people face in other industries. So it's the old boys network. So to get a construction job, you work for a company, you work for a foreman, you work for a super. If you can bond with a foreman and a super, you can go on to the next job with them. Women don't necessarily have the skills or have the opportunity to bond with them in the same way that the other guys do. To advance in your trade, you have to learn skills. And you learn that on the job working, you learn it in the classroom, the apprenticeship program. But a lot of times in the carpenters union, you'll learn it by doing side jobs. And so a couple of guy carpenters will know that they're going to go build a house next weekend, and they'll invite some people to come. They may want to invite the women, but then they're like, my wife doesn't want me, working in the house with women. So it's, that's what we're hearing. So they don't get those opportunities to learn those skills. There's a lot of people who don't lift that. It's too heavy for you. And then the woman might step back and not lift it. And that just sets up this bad pattern of not being out there and doing the things that you need to do. And there's a lot of issues with childcare. Childcare is a big issue for women in the trades. You have to get up at 4 or 5 in the morning to get to your job site at 7 a.m. Where are you going to take your child? If you have to get overtime work, you're going to find out about it maybe like 2 in the afternoon. You have a child that you have to pick up. We had one of our graduates kind of come in and talk to us as part of market research about how she used to use her child as an excuse for not getting overtime. I can't get overtime because I have to take care of this child. But then she realized she was doing it completely wrong. She should be using her child as a reason she has to get overtime, because she has to be able to provide for that child. And women are scattered. The women who are in the trade very rarely work with other women. The Carpenters Union is one of the bigger unions and has the most women historically. They have this very strong women's committee, so they get a lot of help in doing things, but most women are out there on their own, and so they don't know how to figure out how to solve problems. We've heard a lot of the I don't need why would you send me a, you know, the union, you want a worker, a contractor wants a worker, they call a union hall, send me five plumbers. I'm going to send you these, you know, five people. Why are you sending me another woman? I already have a woman. It might be a job with 200 people on, but they think they already have a woman and they don't want another woman. We had a carpenter who, you know, so successful, a hard worker. In New York City, you go and you shape jobs. And so you don't have work, you can go in some of the unions and stand at the job site before it starts, and you're there with your tools, and I want to work today. And some people get called in. So one woman, hard worker, carpenter's union, goes up. She's there with her tools, she's there ready to work. Is anybody ready to work? And the guy says, I am. And the foreman who's doing hiring says, okay, come in, do you have your tools? And he says, no, I don't have my tools. So she says, I am, and I don't want you. Even though you have your tools. And he even said, no, I want to, you know. And luckily in this day and age, that can be stopped in a better way. The unions are working hard, I think, to try to deal with it. So what ended up happening was he said, I don't want a woman, I want a man with tools. And because she was in the carpenters union, she was able to go back to people at high levels in the carpenters union who are women and make sure that didn't happen. But it doesn't always work that way, of course. Sometimes when you try to present something as an issue, you just become the it can hurt you. So what we've learned and what we're planning to do in the next 5 years is really try to help these women who've gotten out of our program stay in the trades and advance in the trades by doing things like setting up networking opportunities for them, setting up mentorships for them, setting up hard skills training for them, and really giving them the ability to have each other to talk to so that they can say, when this happened to me, this is what I did. Because it happened, you know, I came into this job 3.5 years ago. I used to manage construction back in the late 80s, not hands-on, but as a project manager. And until I heard what all of these women said in this last 6 months of market research, I thought it was a much prettier picture out there. Because we hear, as you know, the people who are trying to place women, oh, it's good, we want women, we love peppermint, all of that sort of stuff. And what we really found from what they said is, yes, they'll go to a job and that'll be the case. And there are a lot of men who recognize that they have daughters and they have wives and they have people that they would never want to be treated this way. But every job like that, there's a bad job. We're honoring a woman next Thursday at our luncheon who's an operating engineer today. Today, I mean in 2010. She works at JFK Airport and they're building the runway there and they have to drive on a bus to get to where they're going. And she's with adults, these are adults, and when they drive that truck to the runway, they see a woman and they like hoot and holler out the window. And I mean seriously, like these are grown men. It's to be said that there are issues still, tremendous issues. And we're working, one, to increase the demand for women on job sites so that there's more women on job sites, because the more there are, the better there are. To give them more opportunities to mentor and work and see each other and get the skills that they need, and to really work from the top down, bottom up, but the top down also, ensuring that there's ways that this isn't accepted anymore. And we would like a few years from now for diversity training and combating stereotypes to be as common on a job site and basically having a respectful workplace that is common on the job site as safety has become, ideally, in the last 5 years. So, thank you.
Okay, I'm a moral worker. I quickly wanted to start off by saying that I'm kind of, I had a different kind of case getting into the trade. I know a lot of women went through new. I went through new. And a lot of them came, not because they were always interested in construction, even if they were handy, but because they needed something new in their lives. And as Amy said, you know, even their mothers discouraged them, their partners, and like, you know, my mother is an electrician, my grandmother's a machinist, my father, you know, always supported me to do whatever I wanted. So, you know, I knew from when I was in high school that I would get a job in Lima, which is exciting. Where and when and how? You know, the how is definitely the hardest part. So I moved to New York. I'm from Michigan, and I found out about you, which was just a wonderful opportunity for me. She talked a lot about news, so I'm just going to say, for me, what was the most important thing? And she commented on the math class, learning fractions and how to read tape measures before your first day of work is crucial. You know, like, it seems really obvious, okay, a quarter inch and a half inch, and there's all these things in between, and you have to learn how to add them in your head. And if you try on your first day to do that, it doesn't look good on you. So if you have a woman like Lana, a great math instructor, teaching you for a week, just feeding it into you how to do it. When you get to the job, you're doing it better than mechanics have done it for years. Really awesome. And secondly, carrying items. As an apprentice, you carry things all day, every day. They're heavy. The compound bucket she was talking about, 60 pounds, it has to be carried on the shoulder. You can't like lean over one side and try to carry it with one hand. 12-foot ladders, 14-foot ladders, tripods, their vices, all these things, and sheetrock. I put length of sheetrock. It's not that they're impossible to carry, it's that no one shows you the right way to carry it on the job. You go through new, and they not only show you the right way to carry it, they show you the right way to carry it up the stairs, out the street, around people. That's what happens on the job. So when you get to the job, and on your first day, you can pick up that vice or the compound with sheetrock, just like the guy. It's that much easier for you, just starting off. So I know for me that was probably the most helpful. And often I'm asked on the job or on the subway if, you know, how did I get into it? And I always carry new parts in my wallet and pass them out. Because, again, as you said, the more women in the industry, the easier it will be on all of us. But I was also really lucky because New and Amy hired me to work for New after I finished the course and had to wait for Local 3 to accept me. So I did data entry and I worked as a secretary helping out with the day program. And I even got the opportunity to teach a self-defense class about de-escalating sexual harassment on the workplace there, which was great. And when I was teaching, I was like, oh, you're going to need it. So just pay attention. You really do need it. You know, I think I just said these things because I had to teach it. But the sexual harassment is, it may have changed, but it's still there every day. And, you know, there are new ways to deal with it. I finally did get into Local 3, which is different than the other trades in New York. One is the biggest, I think it's at 30,000 members. Not many women. I don't know the numbers, but very few. You're not allowed to shape your own work. You're not allowed to go to a job and say, I'd like to work for you today. They say so with a lot of other people. You know, call the union, right? You also have side jobs. If the union finds out you're doing side jobs outside of something very small, you can easily be kicked out of the union. So a lot of those things are just a little bit different. But when I was going in, I wasn't really nervous about learning electrical work. You know, in fact, both my mother and my uncle are electricians, and the electrical theory wasn't new to me. I've always been interested in math and science and practical application of those. So that pretty much is what electrical work is. You know, that includes pipe bending, circuitry, and just installing things. You know, all those things kind of came naturally to me. What I was really nervous about was safety on the job, and in all honesty, just the sheer size difference between me and my counterpart. I remember thinking about this before I was going in, but I was like, can I lift what he can lift, or can I reach what he can reach? You know, I'm 5'2", and a lot of guys, I mean, you know, 6 foot or taller, so it's a big difference. So after a little bit of time on the job, you know, I learned that, yes, I can lift what he can lift, or I can reach what he can reach. There's a proper way to do it. I'm going to get a ladder, and I can reach what you can reach. And at a certain point, you learn that everyone needs a ladder. Or at a certain point, every job is a two-person job. You know, that you don't have to carry it alone if it is too heavy, but, you know, you do your best. And top someone will come out and help you, just like with them. But it's, you know, one length of 4-inch galvanized pipe is 110 pounds. There are men who can carry it. I've never seen anyone try. Because, well, I would do it. It's the same thing for me. You know what? 3-inch baby pounds. I can lift it up. I can carry it. If there was someone standing next to me, there, I don't know, one guy who would let me pick it up on my own without yelling at me, that, you know, that I'm going to hurt myself for no reason. He wouldn't come to my aid and help me or ask me to carry it with him. So for that, I've had pretty good experiences. Also, on the job, the question then became not, you know, could I lift this or could I carry that or reach this? It was people would ask me questions. Hey, Laurel, what's the formula to do this pipe bend? Or how do you hook this up? And I realized really quickly that, especially in the electrical industry, it's knowing your formulas and the code book, which is like this thick, pretty short, is most crucial and the best skill you can have in that industry. I mean, there's no one in management doesn't want someone who can do the work quickly. You know, a lot of guys can carry something heavy, but if you can actually do the work, really know the formula, do it well, that's what they're looking for. The industry itself has changed, though. The majority of jobs I've been on want you to follow safety standards for insurance purposes, I'm sure, but the GC wants you to use personal protective equipment, and then the challenge just becomes getting your subcontractor, that's your boss, to purchase that equipment, right? So it's all put on you to pressure them, to look up the information yourself from the MSPS reports on the job, or request those reports on the job so you can know what kind of chemicals are being used and what you need to protect yourself. And I learned quickly in this industry and from my mother beforehand that the most important things for being successful is in a male-dominated industry, the positive attitude, ability to ask questions, a tough skin, and in my opinion, the most important is a sense of humor. However, these are all things that are easier said than done because I worked on a deck job, 600 guys, I'm the only woman. You hear a joke the first time. You're like, ha ha, so funny. You make a joke back, no problem. And then the second, third time, you still laugh it off. And by the 10th or 20th time, it gets under your skin and you're telling people to leave you alone, don't talk to me. You know, it can really get to you. So it's easy to have a sense of humor once or twice. But it can get to you. So you really have to have a tough skin and learn to let things go, I think. But when it comes to women in the trade, I've been in almost three full years, and I've never worked with another woman in my trade. I've very rarely been on a job with women in other trades, and unlike a factory setting, women in other trades and I cannot, like, hang out. We can't go to lunch together. It's inappropriate. If you're an electrician, you hang out with electricians. What are you doing with that steam fitter? What are you doing with that carpenter? So even if there is another woman on the job, I would very rarely probably go to lunch with her or see her at some point in the day. There's only a few, a small number of women in the IBEW, and me personally, I've never really looked to be a part of any of the women's groups for specific reasons. For me, the issues that concern me are the issues that concern all workers. Nepotism runs the craft union, so the tactics used against all minorities, including, you know, women or people of color, or just if you're not a part of someone's family, are similar. So the issues in craft unions lie in the fundamental difference the fundamental lack of democracy in the union itself and the right of the contractor to have the hiring and firing abilities, right? The biggest issue is not the union. So for me, the biggest issue facing all unionized construction workers is the ever-growing non-union section. You know, Amy was talking about this 50-story high-rise pushing up to Manhattan are non-union. This is a new thing, and unbelievable. My local, though, does an excellent, and most locals, the carpenters, I know they do a lot of organizing, but they do an excellent job of spending time and money, not only picketing, but organizing, and they give them extra incentives to join. You know, my local has a lot of furlough, a lot of time off. So if you come through the back door, meaning you were organized, you didn't do the apprenticeship and you would have guaranteed work for 2 years. So we try to make it even a little better for you to come in. And the reason why I feel this way, that there's no way to fight for women's rights on the job if there's no job, because non-union is not going to hire us. So if we're not keeping all these jobs union, it doesn't matter how I'm treated on the job. So that's just for me. Because of the competition between union and non-union work, the union has reduced the wages of the apprentices in my union. The majority of the other trade unions make a percentage of what a journeyman would make throughout. My union Prentice makes under $20 until their fifth year, and then the fifth year they make the 24, and then it jumps to 50 when they turn out, they get their belts on the camp, right? So this is just a tactic to keep women out. This might work for the son of a union member who lives at home and his dad pays the rent, right? Because we love nepotism, let's keep their father's son, but single mother can't come in at $11 an hour, work 8 hours a day, go to school 10 hours a week. Mandatory union, mandatory specialty classes. And unlike the other trades, not get paid for school. So this is definitely a way to keep a lot of minorities out. Sexual harassment is thought of differently today. It's the first subject you cover in electrical theory class. Pornography is often taken down when you come into a job, and you have the right to ask for it to be taken down. I'm not saying that means women feel comfortable asking, but there have been certain jobs or certain pictures that I felt uncomfortable around, and I didn't even ask, I just took it down. It was an issue, everyone knew it was me. No one put it back up, right? And then there's pictures that don't bother me, and they get left out. You know, so it's kind of up to me. Like, what makes me feel comfortable? And there are men who point out inappropriate comments by other men and why they shouldn't say that. Oh, there's a lady present. You know, you can't say that. It's awesome. But I do appreciate, you know, what he's trying to do, right? They do try to treat you like a sister. However, the institutionalized rules of the daily tasks are still based on gender. Materials, deliveries, and coffee every day. There's a woman on the job, she's likely doing it. Even if she has more experience, she's a fourth year and there's a first year male. The fourth year woman will get coffee while the first year male is on his tools. And that's something they still see every day. But often harassment doesn't come from your coworkers. So this is my little story. In my first job, which was a great job, I was in this one job, I had a great experience my first year. I was on a job in Lower Manhattan, renovating a building into a retail store, and there were a ton of workers, but very porta potties. There's, you know, rules on how many people can use a porta potty, so they masked that out. And so the GC ordered their own porta potty, general contractor, and they lock it. So, you know, none of the construction workers can use it. But it tends to be that if there's a woman on the job, the GC gives the woman a key, as opposed to getting her own bathroom. There's just one woman, right? So I got a key. And one day I came into the job and their bathroom was, the porta potty was turned around, so the door was facing the wall. So you couldn't get into it, right? So I got, you know, some guys to turn it back around with me, and being honest, I thought it was a practical joke the first day. Didn't think much of it. Practical jokes happen every day, all the time on construction jobs, so you don't always think they're personal towards you. But then the next few days it kept happening, and it kept happening every day. They're happy, I need help moving on. So I went to one of the mechanics that I really trusted, who was really taking me under his wing, and he, I asked him what my options were, what grades. He said, you know, he gets to work a few hours overtime every day. So he said, I'll find out just turning it around, and I'll get back to you about what you can do. And he did, and turns out that it was one of the GC, one of the general contractors who was turning it around. Yeah. Because I got a key to it, right? And all that means that I got a key to it is that instead of, like, there's possibly toilet paper left, and the urine's not on the wall or on the floor. You know what I mean? Like, it's just slightly better. It's not like someone, I'm not in the air conditioning, I'm not that much better, you know, but there's probably toilet paper. So the mechanic told me that I had two options. He said I could call a steward, or I could learn to deal with situations on my own, because I'm going to face a lot of situations on my own. So I opted for that. And he showed me this trick, and I thought there'd be more people. So I'm going to explain the trick. A couple people would be pretty easy. So at a panel, right, you have all these circuit breakers, okay? And when it's off, obviously, the lights can go off. But then they know, because we're the only ones with keys, and we turned it off, right? You take the butt of your screwdriver against one breaker and hit it really hard, you'll trip it. So there's no way they know they turned it off. They'll think that there's an electrical problem. So we would constantly turn off their air conditioning lights and power, so they're off, right? Trip it. And then they would call our foreman and say, oh, you know, the lights are out, the air conditioning is out, it's hot. So, you know, who's in that area? Oh, well, I'm in that area. Well, can you get it, you know, turn it back down? Yeah, a few minutes, I'm just finishing something up, no problem. 45 minutes later, I turn it on. An hour after that, trip it again. Called them back, right? And we did this a couple times the first day. They didn't really catch on. Did a couple times the second day. Didn't really catch on. But by the third day, my porta potty, you know, was never turned around again. You know? So the reason why I told this story, as opposed to many others, because there are other instances of, you know, harassment behaviors, is that there are still men who don't want me on the job. I don't want women on the job. Feel that, you know, scare tactics and a harassing work environment will make us run away. At the same time, they're men who take you under their wing, who teach you what they know, and they truly do treat you like a union subject. So that even with the bad, there are, you know, more guys who are looking out for you in this. And everyone has bad days in construction. Men or women, construction's tough. It's hard, it's heavy, it's hot in the summer, cold in the winter. Women have some bad days due to their gender. Due to men's gender, I guess. But the days that I'm not given the opportunity to work on my tools or not get overtime because my male counterpart gets it, it's frustrating. But there are also days where I get to work an 8-hour shift and I don't feel that I'm a woman in a male-dominated industry, that my gender isn't an issue, I'm really a member of the team. And, you know, that's solely due, and as both of them said, the women who came before, and as you heard about Linda Gilbert's story, we never had days like that. We never, you know, had an 8-hour day where they were just one of the guys. So that's it. Thank you. I work for a contractor, it's owned by a woman, right? And I met her the first day, and she's like, she lives in the shop, the upstairs apartment of the shop, right? And she comes down and says to me, don't fuck up, or, you know, I'm going to fire you personally, right? But in her own way, that was her encouraging me. And she would love it if more women come. But she doesn't have the right to request women, just like she can't request men. And then on the union side, they're always telling us, to have women, how do we get more women in, more minorities in? But the really important part is on the job, who's teaching you, or do I have women on my side of the job? And for me, I haven't had that experience yet. So, I don't know.
My follow-up question to that is, my wife here, I'm a business advisor to entrepreneurs, and a lot of the tricks people come in their 40s and 50s, and but anyway, you get to a point in your life where it's physically more difficult to do it, and you really need to go into the supervisor role at some point. So when you look ahead, do you see that path? I mean, do you think that there will be that opportunity for you at some point?
Not on management side, but that's only for my own political reasons that I don't have any desire to run work, but I would like to be a bigger part of the union, perhaps through Stewart or a rep one day, but... I mean, light duty used to exist in our unions for men over a certain age that they were allowed to do certain tasks. That's gone away in hard times. Hopefully, in better times, we get that back and then we, fight for women too. Before I can think about that, I think about if I ever had a family and what would happen if I'm pregnant and it's going on maternity leave. You can only have 6 months out before you lose your benefits. So, do I choose that 6 months before I get birth or 6 months after I get birth? How do I work pregnant and same thing without light duty? How do I carry something?
Has anyone done that before
you? Sure. A lot of them have partners that have helped. How many do you? You talk to your foreman if you trust them. They're not allowed to fire you for being pregnant. So I'm sure that if you say I'm pregnant and I would like help because I've worked for you for a long time, I'm sure they'll be willing to help you out. But again, it depends on the shop. Management. Our union brothers, our supervisors, and our Supers are also card-carrying members, so we would like to think that they're on our side to help us. But again, I've never been on a job to see it with another woman. It'd be hard for me to know. But technically, there's no like to me.
But to add, for a lot of people in construction in Detroit, a lot of people, Bennett, both, their pre-retirement was getting a job at Chrysler or GM and Ford in the trades because they would, we run lines, which means we're sitting down a lot, and they'll be working on a construction project if we haven't been able to bid that work in, and they'll be over there with time breaks and really working. And they'll look it up, and they'll say, when I can't do this anymore, I want that job. And so we've had influxes of, large influxes of people from contracting. It's much lower wages and big free. But on the other hand, it's much easier work, and on top of it, it's steady work. And you're not sitting on the bench, and it's year-round work, and you're not, you know, it's hot in the summer in the plants, but at least you're indoors. And so, but that's not true of you. You don't have that option.
And again, even if you wanted to be a supervisor, if you wanted to be a foreman or a general foreman, there's nothing guaranteed. You could be a foreman for a year, and then, you know, the super chain, and get a super, and you're back on your tools the next day. Or let's say you were out for 10 years being a foreman, and then they put you back on your tools, and then you take 5 or something. You know what I mean? And you can see these guys in their 60s, hurting. Every day, hurting. Doing this work. So I really don't have a great answer for it.
That's exactly what happened to me. I lost an election when I was 61, and I went back on my tools and found that I was losing my vision, and I only didn't have depth perception because I had only a vision of one eye, and that wasn't so great. And working as an electrician with poor vision is really dangerous. And I retired because I couldn't do that anymore safely. Fortunately, I could retire. Fortunately, I was old enough that I could, that I had a small pension because I hadn't worked for 30 years. But that's exactly what happens. We used to have people who, the apprentices, you get an apprentice. The apprentice will do all the work. So we even had people with emphysema, sitting in oxygen tanks, right? All the apprentices did the work. So they did finish up their 30 years of work as long as they want. But plants are so lean that there's not enough people to do the work, let alone carry it.
So for us, even if you want to be a union rep, have to work on their tools. We don't get elected, and then
we don't get elected.
We don't get elected, and we don't get an office. You're appointed, so one. That's the nepotism. You know, it's not like I could run one day and hope that my politics would stand for itself and someone would elect me, right? Someone has to like me, and the bosses have to like me. And then you're still on your tools, anyway. You're supposed to work 7 hours and do your union stuff. You have to work for overtime.
Yeah, and many people get paid.
Yes. Yeah, you get paid regular salary. It depends what rep you are, but in my union, stewards get, just like a foreman, would get the extra overtime on the job. That's when they do their union business. So like you'd work your 7 hours, right? It's not like the carpenters have a steward on every job. So they're just a steward during the day. You know what I mean? They have a steward on every job. My steward, he might be the steward of 6 jobs. He has to work his 7 hours and then still do his union business for all these other jobs after work, so he'll get paid the overtime it takes to do it. I think it would be better to have a steward after the union.
And what got you into this?
I'm
sorry. Go ahead. Monopoly. Go ahead.
I just wanted to make a few comments.
Could you speak up?
Yeah. Living from Canada, our experience is a bit different. So prior to my returning to university and finishing my master's in psychology and psychology, ICI, Industrial Commercial Institution, all in Canada, is about 30% penetration of the union. And then depending on who they are doing a job for, let's say a university, the deal there is that everybody on site has to be union in order to get back to the contract, to be awarded to that contractor. But in residential construction, builders won't hire union people because of the cost, and production builders in particular, you know, they're focused on quantity rather than quality. They need warmer to build a house, and you know, they're not interested in the safety regulations that you have to meet if you've got EV people on site, and you know, all the so I actually had to leave construction because I couldn't maintain adequate life balance. I would work 10, 11, 12 hours a day, 5 or 6 days a week. That would be standard day. So I would be leaving the house at 6 or 6:30 in the morning, and my daughter would have gone to school yet. And then I would get home at 5:30 or 6 at night and have to cook and clean and help with homework. And at times, as you know, getting a good amount of sleep for your body to repair is hugely important. And so I actually, in Canada, what's happening is the government has recognized that the baby boom generation is leading construction, and the traditional young male is not entering skilled trades. They're not interested in that hard and dirty work, and they'd rather, you know, do light work. And also, Canada's immigration policy has changed so that we no longer award immigration status to what were traditionally construction workers coming from other countries. Now we privilege PhD graduates who have English as a standard English as new immigrant base. And so we don't even have that. So they, you know, the government and the industry go as well. Which will help us also because we can erode the wage structure, you know, which goes hand in hand with getting moved into new occupation tradition. So I did a course that helped, you know, was specifically focused on, it was different than yours, it's a 30-week course to get women into skilled trade occupations and into carpentry. But our difficulty in Canada is with getting union access. We don't have training. We don't have a history of worker centers or anything like that. The carpenters union from my area, when I went and knocked on their door many, many, many times, said that they already had one of the carpenters union out of the 300, and that they were quite happy with that. The IBEW, for example, in our area, will refuse to even take her name. So, you know, to say that union jobs is the way to go for women, I wholeheartedly agree, but the gatekeepers are so strong at keeping women out of the process that it's unrealistic. So, and just from a sociological point of view, really in the work literature, it's not until you have 15% presence in a male-dominated occupation or in a hegemonic occupation, will that occupation decide that maybe we should start changing? So for Canada, the staff on residential construction is about 1%. And for ICI, it's maybe 3%.
Even if we even here, we have the same number.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, we're far short of the 15%. When I look at women in policing, for example, you know, even there, it depends on the rural-urban divide. So if you think about women officers in rural communities, it's only about 50%, whereas in most urban centers, you know, police officers now are about 15 to 17%, and that's not America-wide. That's not just the United States. And, yeah, so just to speak about your, you know, the anecdotes on having children, at least in Canada, we have the term parental sponsors. So we have 32 weeks of paid maternity leave, which you can take before and or after the birth of your child, plus an additional 10 weeks of paternity leave, so that either partner can take that additional 10 weeks. We're talking about 32 paid, and that's not paid with your full salary. It's 60% and up to a cap of the maximum, but many employers talk like that. And so I am staggered that in the States, when you have not advocated for this, because I don't understand why you don't see it as an individual responsibility to raise the next generation of workers and people who are going to support us in our old age, and expect women to bear the brunt of this. So the point of my whole long rambling thing is that my research is really, even though it's focused on men's experiences, it is informed by my experience as a woman and not wanting another generation of women to enter a male-dominated occupation and unable to sustain it. We're talking about working, we're not just talking about, you know, a few years here until you have your kid. You're talking about the life goals when it comes to having children. And leading to retirement age. So my hope is when I finish my work, I will inform government policy in order, based on the research that I'll be doing, to say, you know, if men are happy with the status quo and they're quite happy with the work-life balance that they have, meaning that it's mostly work and less about love, except for drinking and having a little bit at home to take a meal, then women need to know that, because if we're going to be entering onto job sites and that structure that's in place today is the structure that's going to be in place. Those are decisions to have to make as an individual worker who's ready to accept that, rather than looking at our kids in order to want to change. I don't think you either need to change.
Well, in response to something you said about us not advocating for community, and it goes so far past that. I know birth control is not covered, but Viagra is. You can only see one OBGYN and that's half leaving you home. It's, you know, I mean.
Well, see, we have people in the universe.
Exactly, yes.
You know, it's not an issue for us. You know, our employers are not paying health care benefits. You are not paying health care benefits on the patient. And I don't have to phone up the government and ask them if I'm going to be a doctor or if I don't have to go out and get home. So, on that level, you're already disadvantaged, and then you've got a maternity leave or a lack of maternity leave on top of that. Yeah, I truly don't understand why people in the country are, like, you know, on strike from life until these things change. Because you raise the level of life for a woman, and that means the whole community prospers, not just that woman. So,
it's a psychological. I mean, I cannot only not get birth control, but I can't have a training. They're leaving me with no option.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's
well, even today, men look at women as a liability, especially women of childbearing years. Or, like I say, my research is in the world of work. And so that's really consistent, no matter what country you're talking about.
My generation in the States advocated. We advocated for that, and we marched. I mean, we were lucky. We advocated for legal and safe abortions. We advocated for women's access to the workplace. Right now, however, I mean, we've got a very different political system. It's not that we're not advocating for. In 1993, federal government passed a law called Family and Medical Leave Act, and all this says is you're entitled to the equivalent in hours of 12 weeks a year for certain covered illnesses, chronic or acute, either you or a family member.
unpaid, you're covered for that. 12 unpaid weeks where your boss can't fire you if you're if you take all 12 weeks for
maternity.
No, for maternity.
But not, I mean, they're just hiring for any reason. There's
right.
No protection of the train.
And there's no pregnancy.
Yes. But that, believe me, it's not something that the women's movement, when there was a women's movement, has not advocated for.
Well, I mean, I'm 52, so I have seen the spectrum of, you know, the 60s and the 70s and the changing of the work environment and snowy and all that kind of stuff. And I'm appalled, I'm truly appalled with the lack of solidarity amongst women for women's issues. And, you know, we used to have in Canada the National Council for Women, and that had its own portfolio, and it was regardless of what government was in power, and they were constantly on the news and advocating and advocating and making sure that the answers were better there. And now that's been reduced to the secretariat, which is pretty much like easier to go on. Nobody opens, you know, the talks to them as they anymore. And then the generation of women that I'm in school with, because, you know, I'm 52, I'm older, I'm older than all their parents, for goodness sake, that are at university with me. And, you know, I'm just flabbergasted at the naivete of how that can change.
She needs to raise the kids because it's wrong that someone else raises
right.
Your kids. That's why
I
work so hard.
More traditional though, the male trained.
Yes, but there are, I'm going to say they're 35 and older. I wouldn't say anyone. I don't really hear people my age. I'm early 20s saying it that much, but 30 and older, I hear it every day that their wife needs to raise the kid, not another person. Well, what about you? You're also part of that family.
Well, in the plants, skill trades much more than in production. Men would say to me, I would never let my wife work. And I said, well, so what am I, chopped liver? I mean, you know, this is, I'm working, my mother worked, your husband gave you permission to
And until you can just say, well, I need this to, you know, pay the bills, whatever. And it goes right over their heads until one of the very senior guys that I represented, who had been paying child support and alimony for many years, because if you work 80 hours a week, you know, you don't have a family life, and then you don't have a family. And he started going out with one of the women electricians in the plant. And he said to me, you know, this is really great. She has money too. And when we go to Florida, we can rent a boat for 2 weeks. And it was this revelation to him that that a woman was a partner, he was an electrician, she was a woman, and that, gee, you know, he went from being one of these guys that I would never let my wife work to like, wow, this is really amazing, you know. But that's very rare. And that more like you will hear an older guy, either on my wife working or my son should have that job.
Yeah.
And so, of course, the answer to that, depending on one of the women I represented, said, if your son wasn't as big a dumbass as his father, maybe he could pass the test. And so every woman has a different way of approaching it, and we all get told the same things. And but it's the whole idea of living in a country and in a society that is politically individualistic, economically individualistic, and that rates people on whether they succeed as individuals is one of the greatest barriers to union organizing in this country, because the media has pushed it, both political parties have pushed it, that you don't exist as a collective of workers or women or working class or even just citizens deserving of certain things. This is something you know,
you talk to identify with the employer.
Yeah.
Versus identifying with other people who do your same trade or same industry or just both working class. But even they're union brothers. We pay the same dues to the same people. We're forced to like only have one screw gun on the job. We have to fight each other for it. And we do, versus going to the employer and saying, you need two screw guns on this job. So they can see who's going to fight just a little bit harder, get more work done, and we'll keep him than another guy, right? And all our jobs are based on just kind of pitting us against each other. And then that's representative of our economy in general, not just, you know, in the trade.
Well, I mean, capitalism is predicated on the fact that money at home is doing the domestic work for free in order to support a person's participation in the workforce. And in a two-parent working family, if you have the luxury of a two-parent working family, and that's our experience, but in two-parent working families, the assumption is that the woman at home, who's taking care of all of the domestic work, so that the man who participates cannot have to be bothered with thinking about domestic issues, so that he can go off and then what happens to women who are in the workforce as well, who is there full-time domestic support, unpaid, at home, helping them organize their life, you know, and yeah, I mean, that's a huge struggle that I think that North American society has not grappled with at all.
No, right, and that I could not have done it had I not if I didn't have parents, I didn't have a mother who was a machine, so a father who had this weird idea that even back in the 50s and early 60s, women could be anything they wanted to be, and go to college for more than an MRS, you know, and that, but if I didn't have a partner who understood the importance of being a union rep, of being on the job, not just having this job, but fighting to be a union rep on this job, if I did not have children who understood that politically this is very important, not just on women's issues, but on union issues, on societal issues that it would have been overwhelming. It still is overwhelming, but that there's no movements around almost anything in the States. Not women's, the anti-war movement is small, the union movement is going away, and that, as you say, you know, capitalism, patriarchy, whatever you want to call it, that as we retreat back into individualistic capitalism, all of those things that buttressed it, like more patriarchal norms, start coming forward again, and you see that a women's movement that's anti-abortion, or that where they put a few women speakers in the front to look like it's women leading these anti-abortion movements, and I look back and it's well, they're going to have to do it all over again.
But the difference is that in whatever the case is, medical rights or getting out of jobs, well, I have programs to help me, or even just women in general. You know, there's no clinical program for you to, let's bypass this test and get it, or it's just one aspect of something and help you get it. So, like, those things, they do exist to a certain extent, but it's finding that stuff. You know, especially like the patients talking about the campaign with the pictures in the subway. It's more there with that. There are more calls than before, right?
But it also, and I've given out your name to an organization called Alternatives for Girls. I've given it out to the IBEW president in Detroit, was appointed, but that's not the main principal officer of that union. And it's everybody, it's sort of like, well, who would start this sort of thing here? And so I guess that maybe that as I'm retired from active union work, that's not just getting my PhD, which I have, but that's one of the things that falls to those of us who can't work anymore, is to try to mimic this model as best we can.
The difficulty there is that you're still relying on the cooperation of predominantly male dominators.
And that's all Governor Sanders.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, we as women, we're not even able to set our own course because we still need the cooperation of these male institutions in order to give us access. So they'll give them the jobs that they will pay. Again, that journey with status is still up to that organization or up to that patriarchy to grant access for women. So we're still not in control of our own fate.
We're moving towards it, and we're seeing progress. If the jobs come back, I think we'll make a huge.
There is more than a